Good morning. Hi, everybody. So nice to see you here. My name is Meira Blaustein. I'm the co-founder and executive director of the Woodstock Film Festival, and it's so great to be back here at beautiful White Feather Farm. It's not raining. The sun is shining. It's Sunday morning. It's a beautiful day. And I'm so happy to bring to you such a wonderful, wonderful panel this morning. But first, I want to tell you a little bit about the Woodstock Film Festival. This is the 24th annual festival, and we have been going strong since Tuesday night, doing a lot of film screenings and panels and live concerts and parties, lots of parties, and really fantastic award ceremony last night. And it's going to go on until late tonight. So check us out, woodstockfilmfestival.org, and join us for more events. There will be two more panels here today, right here at White Feather. You can just stay here and go from one panel to another. They're all fantastic. I want to thank specifically Sarah Johnson. She's right over there at the end. She is the owner of White Feather Farm, and she's an organic farmer and a producer, an executive producer, and a champion of a lot of filmmakers and a part of the Woodstock Film Festival. So very thankful to Sarah. And thankful to everyone who supports the Woodstock Film Festival, which is a 501c3 organization, meaning it's a not-for-profit organization supported by donation and corporate supports and grants and family foundations. So we always invite audience members to join our community and support us as we continue to grow into next year, which will, again, will be our 25th. But enough about that. So this morning panel is very special to me. You know, SAG and AFTRA are still in strike. Actors have very difficult time talking about their work because part of the whole guidelines of the strike is you cannot promote your film, you cannot promote past films, present films, and what you're working on. So we're very, very lucky to have a few actors here who actually are able to talk about their work, and they're, each and every one of them is amazing. We have two actors here with films at the festival, and one who is a big part and a friend of the festival and a local hero. And I would like to bring them all here and then just talk about the work in front of the camera and behind it and what motivates them to do what they do. So Mary Stuart Masterson is our moderator. And welcome, Mary. And Steve Buscemi and Matthew Medin are our panelists. Welcome both. Please join us. And thank you all for being here.
Hi, everybody. Hang on a second, I can't.
Without the glasses. It's very important. Thumbprints.
I recall when Mel Gibson got his Oscar for directing, he said, "But what I really want is to act." I laughed. Because I think probably all of us have started as actors and evolved into directors. So that's something we all have in common here. But first to mention that Brittany is not well, and that's why she's not here. She's a terrific movie in the festival. I don't know if you've seen it, Parachute, please do, because it's terrific and important. And so she would really have loved to have been here, but she could not. But on the subject of, let's start with acting. I feel like both of you have such huge careers. I admire both of you so much, and such extraordinary bodies of work you both have. And so I feel like if we just kick it around and make it feel more like a conversation, it'll be a little more fun. To just sort of talk about first maybe your acting training background, like what the beginnings were like for you both as actors. Matthew, do you want to speak to that?
Do you have any training?
Do you have any training? And what is it?
Yeah. It's funny. Somehow I got on an algorithm on Instagram where I'm receiving clips of actors talking about acting. And I just want to say, shut up. Stop talking. Because some things are... I think acting by definition means doing. So you always have to ask yourself, what are you doing in order to accomplish it? So the training is... you know, I studied with Stella Adler when I moved to New York City. I studied with a man named Art Wolf. It was a scene study class, which was invaluable because every week we had to bring in a different scene. So it was just reading a lot of plays and a lot of scene work. So you learn a lot about who you are and what your strengths and weaknesses are, where you need to focus and to be better. But I think the whole journey and what I learned from Stella Adler, what I've learned from life, what I've learned from working with people like yourselves, although we've never worked together, we did. Yeah. That's right. The real blonde. The real blonde. Sorry.
Yeah, but we haven't.
Like that. Tom DiCello's made it. Yeah. Is that really what it comes down to is compassion. In Harper Lee's book, To Kill a Mockingbird, she says through Atticus, we never really understand another person until we get inside their skin and crawl around in it. And what that means is that we have to be able to see ourselves in others, you know, that we have to go on this journey to try to understand human compassion. And that all of the problems that we're faced with in the world today, whether environmental or economic disparity, all comes down to this strike that we're living through right now. It's just basic greed and not being able to see the humanity in another person. And what actors and filmmakers, authors, artists do, I believe in general, the one thread that they all have in common is the ability to see themselves in someone else and to allow someone else to be seen through you.
That's an amazing point. And I think the acting lens is subjective and the director's lens is, you know, more objective, but the experience of being an actor obviously lends itself to being a good director, I would say. Did you feel like you knew you wanted to be a director, Steve? Did you?
Oh, no.
So you might be called the dirty word method actor, which is a really misunderstood term, as like you have to have been a murderer to play a murderer, which is not what method.
I have done that.
Yeah. Well, yes, of course. But method acting or acting, Lee Strasberg, I think.
I went to the Lee Strasberg Institute, but I wouldn't call myself a method actor. And in fact, I was there for, like, I did the 6-month course where you take 4 acting classes, a voice class, a movement class. And it was great. I was like 18. I had no idea of I didn't know anything. And so it was a great education. But then Lee's son, John Strasberg, started his own classes.
My godfather.
Really?
Yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Anyway. Yeah.
Because, correct me if I'm wrong, he didn't totally agree with what was going on there.
Yeah.
And so when he left, I started classes with him and his wife at the time.
Sabra
Jones, and I studied with them for a few years, and it was great. But I think the real training that I got as an actor was when I started to work, creating my own work with a friend of mine, actor Mark Boone Jr. We were both living in the East Village in the 80s, and we somehow met and started to write together and perform, and that was the best training that I ever, you know, got as an actor, was, you know, having to kind of create my own work. And that was sort of the genesis of wanting to become, I didn't really want to become a director. I I wanted to write something that, you know, for myself and for my actor friends that we could do.
Right.
And so I did that with my first film, Trees Lounge, but I did not want to direct it. I looked for other directors, but all of my favorite directors that I knew at that time, they wrote and directed their own films. They said, well, why don't you direct this? But that scared, you know, the life out of me. So I made a short film first before I did the feature, just to see if I could kind of do it. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. And I thought, I can't do this. And then when I saw the completed film, my late wife, Jo, edited the film. And she would tell me, just you stay home today. Let me fix this. And when I saw, like, you know, I mean, it's not a great film, but it's a short film that I made. And I was like, oh, yeah, okay, I think I want to do this again. Yeah.
Yes, I'm glad you did. I'm glad you do. And also, just to clear up the method acting thing that I planted a seed, I want to clarify. Method acting is misunderstood to be living, you draw from your experience as an actor to act. Obviously, we all do. We're sentient bodies. We can't not draw from our experience. But method acting is supposed to be using techniques that allow you to access your own memory and sense memory and stuff like that. But often it's misunderstood to be, you know, you have to really stay up all night to play someone who's tired,
but it's also not necessarily the case as a tool.
It's a tool.
If you need it,
and everybody works differently.
Yeah, everybody which, has their own method.
Which
really,
is, which is the next question, which is when you're, let's start about just directing actors, right? So when you're casting, how has your experience as an actor impacted your experience of casting people? I find that to be really interesting. My own experience is, don't make people read if I don't. No, I just want to talk to them. No, you know, but then everything is a self-tape now. Everything is so impersonal, and the casting director is in Idaho and the actors in Brazil and you're in New York. And what is your experience of acting? How has that impacted maybe your compassion for actors?
Are there any young actors here? Yeah. Self-taping, I think, is the worst thing that in the world.
It is.
I may not have a career if it weren't. Yeah, absolutely. Margie Simpkin was the casting director. Remember Margie?
Oh, sure.
She said, that was good. Can you do it again and do it this way? Good. Now, can you do it this way? And in the room, I was being directed by a casting director who was looking for something. And what you're always there as an actor, you're trying to solve a problem. You know, they're looking for something, a solution to a problem that they have. So when you come in, you do your best to be that, you know, that solution. to have to do that on your own. So for those of you who don't know what self-taping means, it means putting now really just your phone on the shelf and pushing the button, lighting yourself.
Play all the parts.
Directing yourself. And this is the thing. Actors are not really sometimes the best judge of themselves and their performances. I'll tell you really quickly, if I can do this really fast.
We're down a panelist, so take your time.
Yeah. So I was trying to get a part in a film that was directed by Stanley Kubrick called Full Metal Jacket.
That worked out.
And so I was in London. I'd done a film called Birdie, and I went to see.
Can we pause? Very much. That so love that so much. Yeah. Okay.
And I saw Alan Parker, and I told him that I saw Alan Parker. Alan Parker said, "Stanley Kubrick, what a prick." I said, "Why do you say that?" And he said, "I sent him a clip from you from Birdie, and he never sent me a note to say thank you, and you got the job." And I said, well, he's directing the movie, you know, Alan. He's probably really busy. I'm sure that he's going to send you a note. So I see Stanley Kubrick, and I say, you got to send a note to Alan Parker and say thank you for sending the clip. He goes, and now, are there children in the room? There's an expression that British people use that we don't use in America that begins with a C and ends with a T. It's four letters. And Stanley Kubrick, who grew, he's a Jewish kid that grew up in the Bronx. He had adapted this word living in England for the time that he'd been there. And he said, Alan Parker, he's a cunt. And I said, why do you... Yeah. And I said, why do you say that? He said, he sent me a scene with you, and it was a wonderful actor named Sandy Krupp. And you're just standing in a doorway yelling at each other. You're just screaming and yelling and screaming and yelling. As an actor, you think, wow, that was a really good scene. I mean, I was really, I was really giving it to him. And he said, luckily for you, at the end of that scene, you're sitting in a cell, because he didn't see the whole movie. You're sitting in a cell and you're looking up at a light. And he said, it was that quiet bit of acting that made me interested in you, because I could look in and see you. Mm. And I thought, that's a really fascinating thing, is that, as an actor, shouting and screaming and showing your emotions, emoting, it all seemed really powerful, and that would be something that would get you a job. But it was the quiet bit of acting that Stanley Kubrick became interested in, why he cast me in Full Metal Jacket. So to do a self-tape where you have to be the judge and juror of your own work and then send it to somebody. And my daughter is an actor, and sometimes she has to do 10 pages of an audition. And there's no way that, I hope that there's a casting director in the room, because she can say, you're a liar. I look at everything. Or he's a liar. Or they's a liar. Because I don't think there's any way that they're looking at 10 pages of an audition. They're watching maybe 30 seconds, maybe 45 seconds, and moving on.
And actors often understand that all that efforting is not always, you know, the performance, right? It's the person sitting in the room. It's how they carry themselves, how they talk about the script or the role or their other work, or before action and after cut. Sabine is here, I think. Sometimes we look for these moments where people are just like at the table, kind of with each other, and then action, and they're like, they start acting,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it's a kind of self-awareness that isn't always helpful.
Yeah.
And after you've been a director, sometimes I find it helps the acting, right? When you go back to your own work, like, I'm working way too hard.
Yeah.
Like, it, you know, just show up,
yeah,
and listen and do, like you said, it's about doing.
I mean, just to embarrass Steve, I've been watching your work for 3 decades, and one of the most fascinating things about you is not just when you're saying words and doing things, but it's the way that you listen. You know, you allow us to fall into the predicament of your character. And it's, do you know what I mean?
Oh, 100%. Yeah. That's wonderfully put. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
That's true.
There's deep humanity there.
But thank you. I'm embarrassed now.
Start talking.
But one thing I learned as a director, like being on the other side and having to audition actors, is that, you know, a lot of times when I would go on an audition as an actor, you try and think what, you know, like what are they looking for? Like,
right,
what, you know, or you'd hear the actor before you,
like, oh God,
you're in the hallway and you hear this other actor in there giving this performance and you're like,
I'm going to leave.
I was going to do that. So now should I do the same thing, or that's what they, should I change it up? But what I realized is, being on the other side of it, is that nobody really knows. Nobody, they, a lot of times the directors don't know what they're looking for. So if an actor comes in and I love being surprised by, like, even if I wrote it and somebody comes in and does it in a way that I didn't imagine, I think, well, that's amazing, you know.
Totally.
So, I mean, I know that oftentimes I would defeat myself, you know, before I entered the room. So any of the actors here, just know that if you're lucky enough now to get in the room,
yeah,
to actually audition live, just know that it's, you know, anything you do can be useful and can be noticed. You know, you don't have to try and be a mind reader of, like, what are they looking for? Yeah.
That's true. I think also entering the room and working, being seen by an actor, they understand your plight, and they have fresh eyes usually. Actors, I find, who direct have fresh eyes. They're able to see in the moment whatever you're bringing in that moment, the next take, or different cuts. A lot of directors who are actors are able to see it fresh because that's what we're supposed to be doing when we're acting, right? Every single take is first time I've ever heard those words, you know? I've never done this before. And if you're able to do that at all, that helps directing in the process of directing. And have you ever worked with an actor where you watched their work and you're just like, fan, like just such a fan, like I couldn't do that, you know? But the actor that you're working with might be your fan, and they might be nervous because they're such a fan of yours. Do you ever have that dynamic where you have to kind of get them off of the fan train? I don't. I haven't. I never had that. That's why I'm asking. Not once. They're like, who are you? Three names. Mary Elizabeth Parker, Beth Hurt Sterson, Giano.
I don't know. I try not to think about that, or maybe I'm not aware that that's, if that's going on. But yeah, I just...
And with writing, I find that people are sometimes, if the part is like my age, my gender, I think people are like, well, why is she casting this part? Why is she not in it? You know, and then there's a kind of worry about being looked at as if you wrote it, you're directing it, but you're not in it. Yeah. There's a little bit of nerves, I think, from colleagues about stepping into that situation. Have you been pressured to act in things you've directed and didn't want to, or have you done it?
I mean, I didn't want to necessarily act. Once I decided I was going to direct Trees Lounge, then I thought, well, now I can't be in it.
Right.
You know, that's what I really thought. And
right.
I started to think of other actors. And in the end, what convinced me that I should do it was, it'll just save time. I don't have
right.
to talk to another
actor. Right. It's one less set of notes.
You know, it's like, I know, you know, the character I wrote for myself, so it's actually better if I just do it. Yeah.
Yeah.
But in other things I've done, I don't, you know, people have asked me, did you want to play that part? And I'm like, I love when I can show up on set, not have to get into wardrobe, hair and makeup, and do all that. I love just kind of...
Yeah, but what I really want is to act.
Yeah. Yes,
right?
Yeah.
Go back to that. Sometimes it's a lot easier. So your film in the festival... The Listener. Has anybody seen it? It's beautiful, a beautiful and really brave film. Did you have a chance to see it also, Matthew?
No, I got stuck in the rain.
Yeah, okay. Not to put you on the spot, but if he doesn't say anything, that's why. But we weren't sure if he was going to be able to talk about it, but we're really happy that he can. You have an incredibly huge voice acting career. And I don't know if you know that about Steve, but he's like in every movie. That's his voice. And so I wonder how that impacted your directing this film, because all of the cast but one are a huge cast of voiced performances that you don't see. And they're really well acted and really well directed, but it's just a voice. And also, she's amazing, but, you know, she's having to act with, did you pre-record all of these actors? How did you cast all of the off-screen characters in the film?
So for those of you who don't know what the film is about, it's called The Listener, and Tessa Thompson plays a home helpline worker, and she's the only one you see on screen. And she works at night and she takes calls all night long. So you hear all of the callers, but you only see her. And what was the question?
Sorry. So badly framed.
No.
Sort of how did you cast them, but did you feel like your experience as a voice actor helped you in working that way, technically?
No, I didn't, because when I've done voice stuff, it's a totally... different way of acting. Like, it took me a long time to get used to just kind of being in the, you know, just by yourself. And they usually just like you to say the line five different ways. That's what you do. You do it right. Line by line.
Oh,
and
wow.
So it's a different way. It's
so
rare.
How did you then, did you pre-record the voices or put them?
It was a combination. And this is all a testament to Tessa Thompson's amazing performance, because sometimes she was really talking to somebody on the phone. Sometimes the actor was on the set just in the next room. Sometimes we didn't have the actors there, so she was doing it with, we just hired a male and female readers just to do the off camera. And then those voices were kind of
replaced.
Cast later.
Yeah.
Yeah. So when you watch the film, you really can't tell who was, you know, it's like, it's all kind of seamless, but I think that's has to do with Tessa's performance. You know, she did an amazing job because she kind of mapped out, you know, in her own way, like the notes that she wanted to hit. Mm-hmm. When she had the real person there to, you know, play off of, it changed. But when she didn't, she kind of was doing it herself. I don't know how she did it.
Isn't that great? You're like, he's this accomplished actor and an accomplished director. I don't know how they did it. But that's another thing about being an actor, I think, that helps directing, is that sense of wonder and having that fresh sense of wonder on the set and amazement in your lead actor like that is additive and not always the case if you don't have a background in acting. Another thing that I think is interesting is my mom was one of the people who was behind at Columbia Film School teaching actors acting for directors. And it's such, I think, an interesting thing. So because if you're not an actor and don't want to be cool, but if you're going to be directing actors, really good idea to know how it feels, you know, because I find that directors who don't act are either like, you know, do it this way, and if it isn't that way on take one, they assume that's not what you meant, that you had intended. It's like Frozen. You've delivered the performance, and now they're going to tell you how to do it. Like, no, it's a process. It evolves. Maybe it's not their take one. I'm working towards something. I don't understand it in the same way as if they had tried to do that themselves, you know, tried to kind of get inside, step inside the shoes of the character, the skin of the character, and it might evolve. And so I think that's a really helpful tool for any director out there to actually just try it. You don't have to be good at it. You just have to experience the doing of it so that you can understand. And I think that's just important. So tell me about your film and the festival. You're an experimental filmmaker. You want to break and change and the form and bring us forward. No, I think it's awesome. I think it's really incredible. Tell us why you started making films of the nature.
Well,
have made these films. I'm sorry, that's not English.
Yeah, this is. We call it an experimental film because film festivals generally have categories. They have documentary, narrative, short narrative. So that if you make a film that's not necessarily a narrative story, that doesn't have a beginning, a middle, and an end, but it's just kind of something that I don't want to describe what it is, because then I'm depriving you of the opportunity of defining what the film is yourself. That's what you should do. You know, that when I often, when I would go to a museum to look at art and have the experience as an individual looking at the art and trying to understand what's happening in this canvas, and then you hear one of those classrooms go by and the person's explaining who the artist was and why he painted this. This was, you know, the blue period of Picasso. And maybe it wasn't maybe he could only afford blue paint.
Right.
You know, right? Maybe he was upset about something and that, you know, blue was the emotion that was going on. I don't want somebody, because now I don't get to ever have an experience. I loved this new Beatles documentary that was on television, and it was so fascinating. There's no question in my mind now, not that there was, but now it's sealed, that Paul McCartney is a genius.
Stone cold genius.
Stone cold.
Yeah.
And, but, to, you know, as a boy, looking at the lyrics of the Beatles songs and searching for meaning and searching for something, that there was something so powerful and so deep inside those lyrics that I was always searching for them and trying to understand them. And then you see Paul McCartney going through, Jojo was a man, Jojo was a man from my back, Jojo was a man. For like four episodes, he's trying to find from Tucson, Arizona. And then he finally goes, Jojo was a man from Tucson, Arizona. And John says, why Tucson, Arizona? He says, it's that place in, you know, where they make the cowboy movies. And John Lennon goes, cool.
Yeah.
And that's it wasn't any more complicated than that. He just, you know. And, you know, life is that way sometimes. You know, why did you go that way? Why didn't you go that way? And there was something. So the metaphysical films, this film is something that I don't know why I made this film, other than my daughter read it and she said she wanted to play the person, and there was a voice speaking to that person, and she said it should be Leon Vitali, who is a genius. And if you've never seen the documentary film Worker, I encourage you to see it. Leon worked for Stanley Kubrick. He was the petulant boy in Barry Lyndon who shoots Ryan O'Neill when he loses his leg. And Leon, after that, he was really fascinated with film editing, but he wanted to be a film worker. And so Stanley had an affection for him, and he took him in. And for the rest of his life, until Stanley's death, he worked for Stanley Kubrick. And I say this without exaggeration. From that point on in Stanley Kubrick's life, he stood on Leon Vitali's shoulders, because there was nothing that Leon didn't understand. He cast the little boy in The Shining. He found that little boy in Danny. And he worked with Scatman. You know, he worked with Jack Nicholson. He worked with Shelley. He cast Full Metal Jacket. He worked with Arlie Ermey, because Arlie Ermey wasn't an actor, and he helped him to become an actor. Lee Ermey was a drill instructor, but that doesn't make you an actor. And so he helped him on that journey of being able to do the things that Arlie Ermey does in Full Metal Jacket. He was just a great guy, but he does the voice of this voice in the film. So when I was studying, I'm sorry, I'm all over the place. I'm like a person like trying to hold on to a watermelon seed. You know, if you squeeze me too hard, I'll slip away. And if you don't, what am I talking about?
Well, listen, it sounds like your film, right? Yeah. Movies are dreams,
yeah,
right?
In Cahil Gibran's, or Gibran, depending on where you're from, his book, The Prophet, he says, we speak when we fail to be at peace with our thoughts. And I think that that's a foundation for so many things that artists do, is that we're trying to understand something, this is really important. Otherwise, how could we make a film? It's so hard. You know, it's really hard. It's so hard to get the money to make the film. It's so hard. Then you got to cast the people. And then it's not just casting the people, it's casting the crew. Making a film is like a pair of lady stockings. That it just takes a snag to fuck the whole thing up, you know. Then they're no good. You toss them in the garbage, because that's why we celebrate film when it's good, because it's a miracle
it's
a miracle. There's so many things that can go wrong when you look at those credits and you see all those hundreds of people. It only takes one idiot to mess up the whole thing.
You know. Yeah. Or, you know, conversely, you could say that everybody's
and
equally
I say
important
idiot with
on
absolute
the crew.
Love. I just love and affection, you know.
Okay, so experimental film. It's experimental panel.
Yeah, so I've made a bunch of short films. I heard this guy David Sedaris on the radio reading his diaries, and I contacted him. I said, I'd love to make this into a film called Smoking. And it was just about a guy trying to have a cigarette. And as the world was becoming a world of no smokers, the guy just wanted to have a cigarette. So it's a really funny movie that David Sedaris wrote. And that played at, debuted at Sundance. I made a film called When I Was a Boy. That was very experimental. Stanley Kubrick said that the thing that ruined movies was when people started talking in them. He said that because when film was invented and people started telling visual stories with a motion picture camera and lenses and things happening in front of those lenses, they had to create a language of storytelling, you know. So that was, it was experimental when it was beginning. They say when the people went to see the first train, the great train robbery, yeah, then the train was coming at the camera. People ran out,
they
of,
ran
the theater.
Out of the theater. They,
that, yeah, this was a new language that was being invented. Then people had to invent editing, and the great, if you've never, Eisenstein, I think is his mm-hmm. name, that discovered that if you have a blank expression on a person's face and cut to a crying child, you think that person's, you as an audience think, oh, that's what the guy's thinking about the baby. And he, why is the baby crying? It needs its diaper changed. It's hungry. You as an audience start to fill in the blank from a blank expression. There was a really great film here called Fuse. And the editor and the actors, by blank faces, were able to pull the audience in so that the first one is really compelling because he goes into a bodega with an Indian salesperson and he wants to buy a fuse. And in that moment, the person selling the fuse is looking at him. He wants to get the fuse because he wants to kill himself. He has a hair dryer and he wants to put it in the bathtub and electrocute himself, but the fuse goes out. So he goes to the bodega to buy a fuse and they don't have any fuses because it's one of those old screw-in fuses. It's a fascinating film. It's very, very experimental. But the look between the two people, without saying anything, says everything. I didn't even think about when I was talking about you being a great listener. It wasn't a plug for his movie. I didn't even think about that. When yeah. I was like,
Well, this will cut together really well.
I'm kissing Steve Buscemi's ass because I want him to cast me in the next movie he's doing. You're a great listener.
But
and I was thinking, people are going to think I paid him to say that. If you could just say the word listen in it.
Just at least twice. Anyway. Third time's a charm. No, I also find that whenever editing, I always feel like editing is the third draft. You know, it's like, oh, here's the movie again. Let's go. Let's remake this story. Now we know what's in the can. And almost always, all the clever dialogue is way too much. It's always way too much. And it's always 80% too much talking, you know. And I think it's really important.
It works in theater.
Because you have to explain in theater. And it's very different in theater, actually. But on film, it's like you say, we're inside of a dream. And we're in a, you know, the environment that we're building is just light and sound. And that's it. And so back to the listener, the sound design is also really amazing. And you know, it's really got like this other dimension because of the sound design. And I mentioned the actors who are off camera. What is your, do you have a particular technical aspect of filmmaking that you love? Like, do you love the post process? Do you not love the post process? What's your prep like? You know, those kinds of things. Is there anything technical that is your favorite thing about directing, or are you not into all that?
No, it's always a challenge for me. Visually, I have, you know, I feel like I still have a lot to learn about directing. I don't know lenses. I don't know, you know, I mean, you don't have to know this stuff. You just have to work with good people that you know, can, but you do have to be able to articulate what it is that you're looking for or just be open to what people, the ideas that people are bringing you,
you know?
And the editing process is a really interesting process because you can sort of rewrite, you know, certain things. You can, like you were talking about, you can steal reactions from something else, you know, like, and put that in and it works. There's just amazing things. Music can change the whole feeling of a scene or without music. Sound design, yeah, just like having, you know, just things that are so subtle that really can just change with how you hear it or see it. And that stuff is, that's fascinating to me.
Yeah, I love post. I love prep and post as much as I love production because, you know, fix it in prep. Don't fix it in post. You can, but it's expensive. Better to shoot it the right way. And I'm always using, you know, working low budget. So it means, you know, every hour in the day is so precious that you don't want to waste a second on something that's not going to make it into the movie. Yeah. On the other hand, you want to have coverage. You want to have ways to cover your
Sometimes
butt in post.
You just don't know what's going to make it in.
Yeah.
And so it's easy. Yeah, that's one of the biggest challenges I've found of directing. You know, I've only done low budget films and you only have a certain amount of time to get, you know, things that you want. And it's so easy sometimes to go, oh, okay, forget it. Let's move on.
Yeah.
And then, you know, you're like, damn, I should have taken my time there. I should have just gotten it. I should have just, you know, but that's where it's good. You know, I mean, I've had a cinematographer friend of mine, Phil Parmet, who shot a couple of films that I've done. I remember, being rushed on set one day and just saying, Phil, I just need, can you just shoot the, and he went, okay. And then he tried to do it. And he said to me, he goes, I can't. Mm. He goes, I artistically, this just feels so wrong. Please just give me 10 minutes to set up the dolly track or this.
Right.
And I swear you'll use it and you'll love it. And I went, okay. Yeah. And he was right. Of course he was right. Yeah.
Another thing that's really, I mean, we're all, not short in the tooth. And I would say, back in the day, we used to rehearse, right?
Yeah.
We used to have time to rehearse Coppola a whole week. You know, and it was mandatory. It was important. And it is important. And now it's virtually impossible to get everybody in an actual room together to even read the script one time before you start shooting, and the budgetary pressures and whatever. It's really frustrating. So, and then on the day, then there's the pressure to, you know, get your shot list, get the day. And I find that that's where prep is so crucial, you know, and I'm super nerdy about shot lists and designing everything. But then also, I mean, I think the best people I worked with really rehearsed it, you know, at the beginning of the day. And maybe an hour, and everybody's like freaking out, pulling their hair out. But then the day goes really fast because everybody is really clear about what we're doing, and we're not trying to rehearse it as we shoot it. And then back into things don't match, because by the time we got to the close-up, the master would have been totally different. And now we're trying to edit this Frankenstein together. But I feel like that is something that I bring to directing. You have to kind of have balls to do that against all the pressures. What are your kind of, do you have any ways of working on the set that you think?
For me, yeah.
I have ovaries.
We say ovaries now.
Yeah, I know. I have eggs. They're decommissioned, but four kids.
One of the biggest challenges that I had directing was when you would rehearse a scene and you'd have the whole crew like standing around, you know. And then I finally figured out, can we clear the room so it's just me and the actors? the DP and the AD. That's it.
Right.
And if you take, I've found whenever I've taken the time to do that,
yeah,
then you know what you're doing, or you think, well, but we have a pretty good plan now. It might change while we're shooting it, but at least I'm not like deciding because everybody's looking at me and going, okay, let's start here and let's just do that. And I get very anxious when I direct. So whenever I can create those moments where I can feel less pressure, because you feel pressure all day long.
And make the actors feel like, oh, we got all the time in the world.
And it's important, you know, for the actors to feel that too.
Right. Yeah. Otherwise, they're just gutting it out. And that's not the way to
If you can rehearse work. Before you shoot, whenever I've done that, it's always gone much better.
Yeah.
I mean, not every, actors are different. Not every actor likes to rehearse. Some actors,
or even just talk about it, you know.
If you have
experience in the theater, helps too, right? Usually, when you're rehearsing a play, you all work together, and then you do table work, where some people FO, and you're at the table with just the people in those scenes, and then eventually you get up on your feet, and then you rehearse on the stage, and then it all falls apart, and then you do a dress rehearsal, then you're in front of an audience. And I find that's also helpful, just knowing the evolution of a performance through experience in the theater. And we have like to compress it into a day or two, you know. When I directed The Cake Eaters back in 2006, I didn't have Kristen Stewart until we started shooting. Aaron Stanford came early. Bruce Dern said, I'm a cantankerous old fuck. You're going to direct me, right? And I was like, yeah. He's like, okay, I'll be there. But he didn't want to rehearse. He didn't want to talk to the other actors. He didn't want to meet them until we're rolling. So like you say, everybody has their own method. But Bruce Dern. Yeah.
Cranky bastard.
Yeah. That's right. Proudly. Proudly. But he's fantastic in the film. But when you have one director that won't, one actor who won't rehearse, and then Elizabeth Ashley was in it, and she's a theater creature and wanted to rehearse. And so, you know, how do you put two different ways of working together? And it's hard to figure out, but you have to be flexible. Yeah. What, you have something you're dying to say.
I
you look really naughty over there.
Is my stomach grumbling or something?
Are you hungry? Can we get you a snack?
There it goes.
I also directed Bruce Dern in my first feature called If Dog Rabbit, which is a shortened, if the dog didn't stop to take a dump, he would have caught the rabbit. It means that if doesn't count, right? You, in your life, you don't want to have any would have, could have, or should have, just done dids.
I love that.
Does that sound like an experimental film? But I had a great time with Bruce Dern. I'm going to tell you really quickly a story. It was really early in the morning, and I'd built a gas station down in Rosarito, Mexico. I wanted the gas station to be the only thing in the shot. This is a good thing. I'm a painter. If you take a piece of paper and it's white, now Matt, you see that piece of paper in your mind's eye. You see it. It's all white. There's nothing there. What your mind is doing, what your eyes are doing, this part of survival, is you're looking for content. You're looking for a tiger in the horizon of the savanna that might be coming through the grass to come and eat you. So when we look out at nature, we're looking at threats. We're looking at danger. I think it's why gossip has a purpose and why scary stories have purposes. They're wonderful stories about moral and survival. So you have that white piece of paper. Now if I make a dot on that piece of paper, do you see the dot? That's where your eye goes. So if it's a white sheet of paper and there's just this Woodstock logo, that's where your eye will go. It won't go anyplace else but to the dot because it's searching for understanding. So I'm filming this. So we built this gas station. It's a dot in the frame. And Bruce Dern is coming in to open his gas station in the morning, and my script supervisor says he shouldn't have his coat on. He doesn't have the coat, and we'd already filmed the scene afterward. I said, doesn't matter. It's early in the morning. He's wearing a coat. It's cold. It doesn't make any difference. It was really cold. It was down by the beach, and it was early. It was probably 40 degrees. But I said, Bruce, but there's something in your pocket. Can you, what is that? And because it was spoiling the shot, there was this big plastic thing in his pocket. He goes, "Hey, it is what it is." So I said, "Okay, that's fine. It is what it is.
If dog so, rabbit."
Yeah. So later in the day, as I say, that we built this gas station, there wasn't anything around, and there couldn't be any trailers or things for convenience to go to the bathroom because it would have been in the shot. So the bathroom was like 2 miles down the road. So what we would do was run off at a respectable distance and pee. And and there was no hiding. You just pee and everybody knew what you were doing. And so it was a gas station. Bruce was sitting on some tires and I was running back from having my pee. And he goes, "Hey, you know, this morning you asked me what that was in my pocket." He said, "Well, you just ran over there to go pee." He goes, "Well, now you know what it is." And I said, "So you've been peeing in a jar?" He said, yeah, I pee in the jar. I said, "What about when you have to go poop?" He goes, "Yeah, I got a jar."
Same jar.
And I said, "My God, Bruce, what do you do with it?" You know, like, because he was the only actor that wasn't living in Mexico. He was going back across the border every night to go back and stay at the Hotel Del Coronado, which was very expensive for my low-budget movie.
And nice
I said, "So do you take it, you dig a hole and put it?" He goes, "Hey, this ain't my country. I ain't leaving nothing down here." And so he was taking his pee
That's
and
so
his poop
kind.
Back across the border. Yeah, yeah.
I have no respect for Bruce.
I wish he was here to explain it further.
Yeah, I'm sure he would. I'm sure he would. Oh, my gosh. How did we get to poop? From balls to ovaries to poop. You've heard it all. Well, I guess one other thing I want to ask, and I have no idea what time it is, so all you people just, like, wave if it's... Oh, look at that. Oh, very good. Oh, thank you.
Say something about directing?
No.
No?
No. You wasted your time with the poop story. Sorry.
You got 30 seconds. Yes, you can.
It was about rehearsal. And it was really... I'm sorry I keep going back to Kubrick, but Kubrick, he demanded rehearsal. So we had readings before we began, table reads, just like a play, you know. And then when we get on set and... actors oftentimes kind of just walk through the scene, you know, not really getting not really acting the scene. You just kind of go half speed.
Yeah, you want to save it.
Yeah, you want to save it for the take. And that's what he would say. And what are you going to do when you save it? He said, "How do I direct the movie if you're not doing what you're going to do? How do I half direct? How do I save it for when I'm directing?"
Yeah.
So he would say, "You have to do it because," and this blows people's minds, he didn't know where to put the camera until the actors did it.
Right.
That the actors informed Stanley Kubrick. I mean, I think 2001, A Space Odyssey, is an exception because of the extraordinary mechanical aspects of what that film is. But he didn't know where to put the camera until he had the actors on the set. And he said 99% of directing a film is hiring the right actors, that they have to have an understanding of what it is that so that they can interpret the role. And in this way, I apologize if you've heard me say this before, but in a way, directing is like being a conductor. That it's not the director's responsibility for the violinist or the percussionist or the cellist or the horns to learn their part. That's your job as an actor. That's your job as an artist, is to learn your part and then bring that knowledge to the set so that the director can say, "Oh, maybe that's great, but maybe just a little bit less, a little bit more," you know?
Yeah.
Two of the best directions I ever received from Stanley Kubrick were very simple. Act scared. It's great. It's so specific, and yet it's two words, act scared. And everybody's going to act scared differently. You know, your scared might be different than mine. You know, how we react, that's your choice as an actor.
My father used to say, my father is the director, he would say, "Oh, just, you know, let people bring you presents. And then you get to take credit for the good stuff, you know." Yeah. I was like, wow, and also for the bad stuff. But, you know, I think that's important, is that you're collaborating. It's a highly, and it's entirely collaborative art form. So it's not just the actors, obviously, that's just a tiny fraction of what makes a film. You talked about the one person who could screw it up, but also your team, your DP, your designer, hair, makeup, wardrobe, everything. And when you involve the actor in the design of their character, of the room that they live in, the objects that they touch, their props, their hair, their makeup, their wardrobe, you have a very complete, you know, collaboration, chasing the dream of making the movie together. And what's frustrating in today's world is a lot of times you sort of step onto the moving sidewalk and they're like, here's your clothes, and no, you don't smoke, and you know, no, you're not, your hair isn't going to be like that, it's going to be like this, we already decided, it's over there, and you're just like, okay, and you're not getting the best of me if I'm just not coming in with my ideas or what I can add creatively. Everybody has something to add or to subtract, sometimes that's more important. Quick question, how do you balance the two aspects, you know, directing with acting in your career? Because one takes a lot longer than the other ordinarily, and even just scheduling or even mental space of, you know, moving your acting career forward and your directing projects. Do you find it hard to balance the two?
It is a challenge. I mean, since I've directed, I have such admiration and respect for anybody who makes their living directing. It is so hard.
It's a young man's game.
To get a movie off the ground, and then it can fall apart. You can spend 2 years or more trying to get something going, and then it could fall apart, you know, at the last minute.
Yeah, then you take the acting gig, and then they're like, well, you weren't available to, and you're like, ah.
But I mean, if you're not acting, if you're a director and that's what you do, I don't know how you manage that. I mean, I feel lucky that I have acting to fall back on.
It's like painting houses. Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, especially if I'm on a series, you know, and it's a lot of months of work, it just takes me out of the game of directing. I'm grateful for whenever I have the chance to do it. I've also been able to direct on some of the TV, you know, series that I've been in. And that's a whole different aspect of it, because it's not yours. You know, you're really...
There's a pattern established.
You know, you have to... It's a weird thing, because they want you to bring, you know, something unique to it, but you can't go too far off what the tone of the show is, you know?
Right. And they have tone meetings where they're like, this is what it looks like. This is how this scene has to feel in this episode. Yeah.
But it's really interesting, because I've gotten to direct things that I never would have, I think, have in movies I've directed, but in TV I've directed car chases, or I've directed a Western. I directed, you know, it's like stuff that I don't think I would ever get to do. And every time I do, every time I direct, I'm always learning something, and, grateful that I had that experience. Yeah.
And Matthew, is there one person that you can't do one of your films without? You know, is it do you have a core? Yourself, obviously. But, do you have a team?
I have an editor, Terrence Ziegler. I think he's a wonderful editor and director. I love Kevin J. O'Connor. Kevin J.
It's your muse.
And he's also Thomas Anderson. What's his name? P.T. Mm-hmm. What's his first name?
Paul.
Sorry, Paul. Paul Thomas Anderson. He uses him a lot. But Kevin, he played my brother in the movie with Bruce Stern, and he's just a really clever, clever artist.
You're directing yourself.
Yeah.
What's that like for you? Because I avoid it.
I think that what you want to do is hire a really good cinematographer, a camera operator, whom you can trust, that you can look at, and he gives you a wink and says, yeah, we got it. Mm-hmm. We can move on.
Why don't we do it again? That was bad for camera. Yeah. Wink, wink.
I try. Yeah. I try not to listen so much, but because the things that I've acted in, I've also written. So I have a sort of deeper understanding of what it is that I'm trying to accomplish, because I know the story that I'm trying to tell.
Kind Do you of like go the, off book?
You were the...
Do you go rogue and then the other actors are like...
No, I don't. No.
Do you like to improvise or no?
No.
Do you?
No, it terrifies me. I've done... You worked with Abel Ferrara.
Yeah.
I love Abel. Yeah. I hate when... Like, I did a film with him and Dennis Hopper, and Dennis Hopper was like, I just wish I had a part. Like, there must be some place where I don't have to say anything. and we were doing this scene in the car where I was talking, and he didn't have to say anything, and he couldn't stop talking. as soon as they said action, he was like, you know, man, I mean, he would fall into Apocalypse Now. You know, man, I mean, fuck, man. I mean, it's just, you know, these sons of bitches, man, these fuckers, man. And I loved Dennis. I mean, he was amazing. But it was like, this was that moment when you could have been quiet. you could.
Steve, you're a really good listener.
I do like it. That story, it reminds me of when I was doing Fargo with Peter Stormare. My character just goes, blah, 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 blah. And his character is just like, pancake house, you know. But if you were watching it, they would, you know, say action, and I'd be up, blah, 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 and then cut, and then Peter would start talking nonstop. Like, I try and be like, I want to think of my lines, but he'd be telling story after story, blah, 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 and then action. He'd go, blah, blah, blah. It's amazing. But I actually do like to improvise, and one of the, you know, I've been lucky enough to act and direct on Portlandia, which they do so much improvising in that, and bless you. And it's really fun. Like, I find that really fun to have, as long as you know your character and you know what you're kind of...
The structure of the scene, where we're going, maybe.
And if you have... Like, they took the time to, like, do that, because a lot of it you're going to throw out. But you might get that one, you know, like that little gem that you never would have thought of, you know.
Exactly.
Or is not written, or that nobody saw.
And it's so alive. Yeah. And there's that little hint of panic get when you're improvising, which is good.
There was an improvised scene with an Abel Ferrara movie. There seems to be a lot of... He was interesting. After take one, we did another take, and I did it the same way that I'd done it in take one. And he came over and goes, what the fuck is that? And I said, what do you mean? What is what? And he said, you did it just like you did in take one. I said, well, I don't know why we were doing take two. So there's a lot of people. Maybe it was out of focus. Maybe you didn't like the other person's performance. I don't know. Why are you doing take two? He goes, I'm doing take two, so you do something different. If you're just going to do the same thing that you did in take one, we don't need to do take two. Do something different, right? And so there was a scene with Beatrice Dahl in Blackout, right? Beatrice Dahl, she's a gypsy French actress, and she wasn't comfortable speaking English. So I said, well, when you're French and you get angry, you probably, if you were in a relationship, you'd start yelling at me in French. So don't worry about English, just speak in French. And she said, okay, I speak in French. And in the scene, I'm saying, did you have an abortion? Did you cut my baby out? You know, I'm really aggressively, and she's scared because I'm all coked up and drunk and I'm, did you cut that baby out of your stomach?
Sound like a great guy.
And she's in French, and she's saying, get away from me, I'll kick your ass. In French, she's saying it. And I keep saying it. Did you know, like a bad Robert De Niro. Did you? And finally, she slapped me across the face. She slapped me across the face, and I didn't know she was going to slap me across the face. But she really slapped me across the face. And I went, oh, yeah? Go ahead. And she slapped me again. I said, yeah, go ahead. But she slapped me again. I was like,
that's a wrap.
Yeah. And then she picked up a champagne bottle and hit me in the head. And I was like, I don't like improvising.
Well, I think it's time to hear from all of you. no. let's improvise. Do we have any questions? from the audience? Yes, sir. And then in the back next. Hi.
You touched on what I wanted to ask you a little earlier about. I want to talk about The Sopranos, where you came later. What was it like directing episodes where all the characters were already fully formed?
Oh, it was terrifying. My first, like, the first episode I directed was in the third season. It was the Pine Barrens episode. It was an amazing script. And I tell the story all the time. When I read that script, I just put it down and I went, okay, my goal is not to fuck this up. Like, just let what's on the page, just try and realize it. You know, I don't have to do anything except...
defensive directing.
Sort of, yeah, just get them all together and kind of like... it's funny when you step into a show that's so established and I'm watching a scene and I would go... that's not the show yet. It's not, you know, and then finally, like, maybe I said something, or maybe we just did it again. I was like, oh, now I feel like I'm watching the show. Now we can move on. But the actors were so different on that. Some of them I knew, some of them I didn't. My first day was in a scene with Jimmy Gandolfini, who I had only met a couple of times before that. And he couldn't help it. He's just this imposing, intimidating guy, you know. And now he's dressed like Tony Soprano, and I'm supposed to say to him, "Can you actually let's just go? Let's just action, you know. Good, good. You know, he'd look at you. Yeah, good. Let's move on. Okay, we're gonna, what am I going to say to him? You know. But then when I got used to, you know, once I got used to, then I would. That kind of melts away, and then I was able to, I think, give direction when I needed to. That was helpful. And I think actors I like when I hear something from a director that's so useful, or something that I didn't think of, or that, you know, all right, let's try it this way. Yeah. So that was a fun show. It was a fun show to do, but it was intimidating at first. Yeah.
Good question. Anyone else? Oh, in the back?
Yeah, I'm wondering if there's something that you were, as directors, determined not to do because of something that a director did. Why you were not?
Good question. That's a great question, because I was going to ask that too. So thank you about, have you learned, you know, from the less wonderful experiences you might have had as an actor? Is that?
As an actor, I sort of pride myself in that I could, you know, see what the director is asking for and try and deliver, you know. And sometimes it is hard, because you step on set. This hasn't happened a lot, but you step on set and say, okay, you're going to come here. Hmm. Then you say that line by the window.
Yeah.
And then you come in and then you
paint you in. Know,
yeah.
Yeah.
And then I have to sort of like think, why am I going to the window? All right.
Right. Well, okay. Figure out why. Blah, blah, yeah.
You know, and so... as a director, I always try and give the actors a chance to see, you know, to see how they would block a scene, and then see where, you know, the problem might lie with my DP watching, going, are they going to be over there the whole
right.
time?
You know, well, you find you're accessing the actor's impulse, but then, but can you do that by the window?
Yeah,
yes,
like,
I can.
It work? You know? Do you think it can work if you did that, but just if you were up and...
Yeah.
And also watching, you know, I don't know how you'd access this anymore, but remember when like DVDs first came out, there would be like the director's commentary.
Yeah.
It was great to listen to.
Now that's called Instagram, you know, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? I mean, sadly.
But it's great to hear how some directors either solve problems, you know, because right. actors would, you know, sometimes actors go, but I don't understand.
Right.
If I'm talking to you, why would I stand over here and talk to you? Like, I would... And I remember John Patterson, who directed on The Sopranos, his commentary, he just said, you know, his answer was, it just looks flat.
Yeah.
If one of you is here and the other one is here and you're turned slightly, it will just be more dynamic. Trust me.
Yeah.
And sometimes actors aren't the best judge
I think
of
dance,
how it's going to look.
Dance training yeah. or yeah. time on the stage yeah. helps with that too, because you know yeah. that you're telling a visual story.
Did you ever hear
space.
The story of Sean Penn on Falcon and the Snowman? Do you guys know the movie Falcon
yeah.
and the Snowman?
So I probably
Sean Penn was he was was he dealing drugs? Is that how he ended up in Mexico? Yeah, so he's all coked out. And there was a scene where he was supposed to be behind a curtain, you know, peeking out because he's hiding at an embassy. And and he wants to see, because he's paranoid, he's all coked out of his head. And he wants to peek outside to see if there's people outside that are waiting to arrest him or kill him. And John Schlesinger told him he had to open the curtain more so he could see out with the camera. And Sean said, no. He said, what do you mean, no? I can't see out. I can't see what you're seeing. He goes, yeah, but this is all the more that I'm going to open. Because he was paranoid. He was coked out of his head. And Sean, when I heard the story, I remember thinking, what an asshole. Why was he being so difficult? Just open it because it makes sense. He's got to see out with the camera. But in fact, then I worked with John Schlesinger, and he was a pain in the ass.
And famously.
He asked you to do a lot of things that were for the camera that didn't make any sense. And what Sean Penn was in fact doing was exactly the right thing. And the shot should have been nothing more than a sliver. Mm-hmm. of what it was. So it's really important that, you know, the actor really begins to understand the movie better, or certainly the role better than the director. The director sees the overall arc of the story and how he's going to edit, and it's evolving and changing. Like you say, that there's the script that's written, there's the script that's shot, and then there's the film that's edited. And they're all three generally quite different animals. But I remember being ashamed of myself for sort of judging Sean for having done that. And I remember apologizing in my mind and saying, you know,
when I see Sean, I'm going to tell him I thought he was an asshole. And then I realized I was sorry.
Well, it was when
it wasn't an asshole.
It was when I worked with John Schlesinger and he dumped cockroaches on me about literally like 30 times.
Nice.
There was a scene where I was looking through a grate and they put me in a bathtub, a little plastic kid pool, so the cockroaches couldn't escape. And kept dropping the cockroaches. He said, no, we got to do it again, to the point where the crew said, we're not doing it anymore. This is
cruel and unusual punishment.
Yeah, it was awful. Yeah. I think that what he was trying to do as a director, he was wanting one of the bugs to go up my nose or in my mouth so that the audience would do that, go, ooh. You know, when you're watching the movie, you want an ooh moment. Ooh.
It's pretty ooh already, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anyway,
wait. We
when you put a bunch of cockroaches in a big pickle jar, it's like a big orgy. It's like a big orgy. And they produce these things called pheromones. So when they dumped the cockroaches, I got those pheromones all over my body. And when I was going back to my dressing room to have a shower, there were cockroaches chasing me.
I had that with bees one time. Keaton.
I just wanted to also thank you so much for this conversation. It's been really wonderful hearing everybody's experience. My question is, you talk so much about sort of chemistry and putting together a team, both the cast and the crew, and that it has to sort of just be right for that magic to happen. And I'm sort of curious to hear about when you run into a difficulty on set or in post, or when you sort of encounter tension, and how do you navigate through that, and you know, knowing that like the creation of a film is such a long process, and oftentimes you're going to be working with these people for a long time, and sometimes even beyond that on new projects, and so how do you navigate tense moments?
Are you good with conflict? Do you leave it up? Do you have a henchman?
I
have someone who off with their heads. That's a great question. The chemistry of a creative collaboration is one that is it's like its own organism. You know, all the bodies breathing together on the set are making the thing. And if anything is off, it affects the whole thing.
It doesn't necessarily mean, though, that you're not going to get something magical.
Right.
I mean,
right.
We read all these stories where you see this wonderful movie and you say, boy, they must have been, they must have had a great time. And then you hear, no, the director hated the actor. And this one, the DP didn't get along, you know.
Right.
And you go, well, then how did they do it? And they
said, that one would eat onions before a love scene just to piss the co-star off. And, you know.
But it somehow gets done.
True
so
story.
It's great if there's good chemistry. And But if there's not, and it's, then you just sort of just focus on what you need to do and what's important to you. I mean, if you're directing, just try and get what's important to you and ask for help. I mean, sometimes, yeah, somebody can come in and, you know.
That's why producer. And, that's why you should have producers, right? But truthfully, like, can you please? It's not, it can't be me. But like, yeah, sometimes you have a chemistry that's volatile that breeds a good result. Some usually actresses in the past would get, you know, reputations for, you know, back in the day, a few minutes ago, being bitchy or being difficult to work with. And the male counterpart might not get that same reputation. But the question is the work good? And is there something that is making that person unhappy, or is that just how they work? Are they just unhappy until they've worked it out? Or is it such challenging material and that's just their process? And how do you make people feel the space to do their work without that also impacting other actors or other people on the crew? And now we have a far more sensitive environment in which to work. And whether it be the need for intimacy coordinators or... you know, a lot more awareness of kind of ourselves and how we behave on set. That sometimes that makes it so delicate that I think we have to be careful, but we want to be, we want to have an open, creative flow. At sometimes those things, can be, I think, slightly, at odds, because people might not say what they're really thinking, or they may not feel full agency to, on any level, anybody on the crew or anybody in front of the camera, behind the camera, to really confront difficult things and talk through them and work through them. Have you guys had that experience where you feel like there's something that just is sort of radioactive and you don't know what to say, and so you decide not to say anything? I mean, this is a bigger, this is its own panel, but I feel like it's a real issue, I find.
As an actor, if I feel it, I just keep my head down and do what I need to do.
Right.
But if you're the director, you know, you want to try and kind of come to some, you know, sort of agreement where, so that everybody isn't feeling tense, you know.
Right.
But it's tricky, and it's a little hard to answer because it's sort of case by case, you know.
But, yeah. You know, jump up and down and make noise usually works. Anybody else? Yes.
Hi.
Hi.
We've directed two shorts so far, and we're about to make the leap into our first feature.
Great.
And while we feel ready, we also feel really intimidated by that. Do you have any advice for making that leap from short into first feature?
Sounds like you did exactly that.
Advice. I mean...
Good luck.
Don't do it.
Don't do it. Walk away.
It really, I mean, for me, because I think it's, you know, it's different for each person that's about to do it. For me, it was making a feature, the first one, and hearing my DP and the production designer and people kind of talking about it, and feeling like I was losing sort of control of it. Like, but again, I had my friend Phil Parmet, when I asked him for advice.
He's so good.
And he said, just let people do their jobs. Let them, you know, and I didn't get it at first, but then I realized, yeah, they were all talking and talking and talking, and then they would come to me and say, this is what, so I realized, oh, I have the final say. As a director, you do have the final say.
You're the decider in chief.
Yeah, but if you're not, if you're not going to let people have, you know, you can sometimes with my anxiety, I would say, and so we have to do this and this and this and and thinking that I knew the way to like do things, but really I didn't. I was just anxious, and
that's really
so.
Good
I think
advice.
It's good to have, you know, surround yourself with good people. You're already on your way because if you've made two shorts, then you already know kind of who you want to work with, or. Just, you know, it's, I've always said this, some of the best directors that I've worked with, they create an atmosphere on set that is, either is collaborative or it feels collaborative.
It's supposed to feel
collaborative. That people feel like that they're being listened to, that they matter, you know.
Yeah. I would add to that the transition from, I presume, a smaller crew and to a bigger crew, even if it's low budget, you're going to have to really rely upon more people, and to make use of that is a hard transition for people who work as a tight unit. And I would just say, open your circle to all of the collaborators you're in prep. Practice, references that are, whether it's a visual deck or something that can say to people, this is the film we're all making. And then, if it's just you guys speaking in shorthand, you won't make use of your whole crew, and they'll be standing around going, what are we doing? Oh, we're doing that next. And then you've lost 10 minutes and everybody's freaking out. But if everybody's part, you have a shot list and everybody has it, it can change. But, communicating with the whole group and making use of them will really help you. I've seen it happen the other way a lot, where it's a cone of silence and nobody can get in. And it worked before, but you lose the benefit of the collective that's there to tell your story with you, So that would be my only non-acting advice. last question.
Hi. I'm just curious, from all of you, now having done bigger roles, but having started with smaller roles, and also working as directors, is there any kind of particular empathy and understanding that you brought to smaller roles for actors as a director?
Is that Ben?
Yeah.
How are you, Ben? I'm sorry, I was like looking at you going, is that Ben? Is that Ben? And now I realize I didn't really hear the question.
Do you have empathy for smaller roles?
Empathy for smaller roles.
No small parts, only small actors. Yeah. There really aren't any. A movie can be spoiled by a small role, not well executed. Yeah. So they're very important.
It's all so important. It's all, casting is like Matthew said, it really is one of the most important things, because if you're not getting what you need from the actor, the best thing for a director is not having to direct,
right?
Right, that was it. Good.
Okay, we can move on.
All right, Matthew, do it again, do something different,
Do you have anything to add to that? Because we're going to have to make
space
for the next panel.
One of my favorite directions
but
is...
But short. Make it short.
Have my stories been going on too long?
No. We're getting the hook. That's all.
I dropped some acid before I came here.
That's cool. Yeah,
I apologize. No, I'm kidding. It's Woodstock.
we all dropped acid.
I think
acid.
One of my favorite directions is... Modine, you're not going to do it that way, are you? It's so specific. Yeah, do something different.
Is he going to do it that
Wouldn't
way?
Wouldn't it be interesting if just for 4 years, just as an experiment, because we take something that is an idea and we put it on paper and then it becomes a film, and all of these hundreds of people come together and collaborate to make it something, to manifest an idea, and then it becomes a film, and that people sit down and watch it and are entertained. Wouldn't it be fascinating if just for 4 years we could run the United States?
Oh.
Wouldn't it be if it was like a film production? Because what we learn to do is compromise with one another, to not look at somebody and say, you're stupid, I'm smart, I'm right, you're wrong, that we find a way to collaborate and work together to be able to solve a problem. This problem that's happening with the strike has nothing to do with the artists that are involved in making films. The producers are not our enemies. The people that are financing the people that are producing the films are the problem. The distribution is what's changed in our life. When they started calling movies content, is when you can sort of
data.
Look and see where the problems start to begin. We're human beings, we want to find a way to work together and collaborate and and bring love where there's hate, and bring peace and understanding where there's suffering. That's generally what everybody in the motion picture industry that I've ever met and worked with wants.
I just see you as IP. Mic drop. Thank you all for coming out. Thank White Feather Farm. Thank you, Mayra. Thank you for being here. Sarah Johnson, thank you. Goodbye.